Welcome to a very special edition of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by GlaxoSmithKline, we pass the mic to Robert L. Coleman, MD, FACOG, FACS, Chief Scientific Officer of the U.S. Oncology Network, and Brian M. Slomovitz, MD, a gynecologic oncologist at Broward Health and a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Herbert Wertham College of Medicine, who provided perspective on the advantages and potential drawbacks of using PARP inhibitors as frontline maintenance therapy in all comers with newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer. To that end, we flipped a coin to determine who would argue for PARP therapy versus against PARP therapy. As such, the views and opinions expressed herein do not necessarily reflect those of the faculty or their affiliates. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Coleman and Dr. Slomovitz discuss the benefits and limitations of PARP inhibition in all comers with newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer and pivotal PARP inhibitor trials in the frontline setting. We're lucky to have Dr. Coleman and Dr. Slomovitz here today with us to discuss the use of frontline PARP inhibition in advanced ovarian cancer. And we will have a pro side and a con side. And to start us off with that, we are going to do a coin flip.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having us. Yeah, we thought we'd take a little different tack. I think we're both prepared to defend either side, but we're going to leave it up to this. And for those of you who haven't used one of these in a while, that's a quarter. All right, ready? Here it goes. Go ahead. What'd you call?
Tails.
Tails it is.
I'm going to take the pro.
All right. There it is. So I'll be arguing for non-PARP therapy. Maybe we could set some ground rules. As far as guidelines go, certainly by NCCN, also by ASCO that just was published a couple days ago, I think most of us would agree that patients that carry a BRCA mutation, PARP would be the standard of care. So probably not going to be able to argue much in that space. But I think the other non-BRCA environments are a good space to discuss. Why don't you lay the case out?
So no, thanks, and you know, this is going to be a lot of fun. So thanks for having me on board. I think the key thing is here. You have to when you're thinking about maintenance therapy for your newly diagnosed patients with ovarian cancer, the first thing that you have to buy into and understand and agree to is that maintenance therapy works. Okay, and maintenance therapy is not a new idea. We've been doing maintenance therapy. Maintenance therapy started long before bevacizumab. All right, you know, it started long before Dr. Markman's study, you know, GOG-178, I think it was, when looking at Taxol. We used to inject radiation, what is it, P19 or
P32.
You know, as a maintenance strategy. So maintenance therapy is not new. It's what's tolerable maintenance therapy is new. And that's what we need to talk about. So understanding that with patients with ovarian cancer, it matters if you could keep the disease away longer. The purpose of this talk is not to talk about PFS versus OS. I believe in PFS. I believe that celebrating Christmas without chemotherapy is meaningful. Okay, going through your family milestones, living your life without being a cancer patient is more meaningful than being on active treatment for active disease. So number one, maintenance therapy works. Number two, you have to choose the right maintenance therapy. I think now, you know, in the current landscape, the active choices are, you know, one of three: bevacizumab, a PARP inhibitor, or both. Okay, and I'll leave it up to Rob to try to defend observation in this setting. But both, he's already conceded that that BRCA patients deserve a PARP inhibitor. I think probably outside the scope of this argument of this talk is, should BRCA patients get Bev with the PARP inhibitor or not? I'm not sure, but at least they should get a PARP inhibitor. Again, number one, maintenance works. Number two, your choices between Bev and PARP, let's divide it into two groups, HRD positivity. You know, Rob's going to say that HRD positivity, we don't even know what that is. That's not even a reproducible test. But I don't care which test you use, if there's HRD positivity, you could help people live long without disease, progression-free survival, by giving them a PARP inhibitor. You could do that with PARP alone, as demonstrated in the PRIMA trial. You could do that with PARP and bevacizumab, as demonstrated in Paola, but there's definitely a benefit to that. So then we're going to leave to the HRP population. The problem with all of us is we always think about the current line of therapy. We look at ovarian cancer patients in silos and we think, what's the best first line treatment for them? I think, you know, as it becomes more and more of a chronic disease, and we keep saying that, which is good, but as ovarian cancer becomes more and more of a chronic disease, what's the best treatment in the first line setting? And then what's the best treatment in the second line setting and the third line setting? Bev is a good drug. Bev, you know, I would probably argue that Bev should be given from day one all the way down through, you know, through first line, second, third line setting, things like that. But although the numbers aren't, the difference is not as great in HRP, homologous repair proficient patients, when you look at the PARP data, there's still a difference. PRIMA clearly shows that there's an overall benefit in progression-free survival in giving a PARP inhibitor, an oral therapy that they can take at home, that you could adjust the dose to minimize side effects, and you could keep the disease away longer. It's statistically significant. It has a favorable hazard ratio. And, you know, Rob's going to talk about the difference between, you know, 8 months or so and 5 months or so. I'm going to say if that 3 months covers you Thanksgiving and Christmas, it's worth it. I think we all want what's best for our patients. And to give them a tolerable therapy that's oral, that has a statistical advantage, you know, you can't argue the statistics. If you want to leave it up to the subjectivity of an FDA approval, it has an FDA approval. I would support giving PARP inhibitors in the first-line maintenance setting for all patients with ovarian cancer.
I think that's a good summary, and despite that it's wrong, it's still a good summary. No, I'm just kidding you. So, you know, I'm going to try to stay polar. It's easy to go to the middle because I think that's the way we all treat patients. We individualize care, but I'll try to stay on the other side, just so you can, so that the audience can hear what the arguments, you know, would essentially align with how these treatment decisions are made. And I think ultimately we probably can come to some consensus as to how we might want to triage specific patients for specific trials. So the kind of the primary argument about the use of therapy in the maintenance setting, and let me step back just one step. So you said that maintenance therapy is not new, and that is definitely the case. We've been studying, and it's not even that we've been looking at drugs. We have done multiple modalities. As you already talked about radiation. We did high-dose therapy. We did alternative chemotherapies in sequence, so not just the same drug like Taxol, but other drugs like, you know, topotecan. And we've done immunotherapy in many different formats, checkpoint inhibitors, vaccines, interferon. And then, of course, we've done anti-angiogenesis drugs. We've done multiple ones of those, right? Nintetanib, bevacizumab, as you mentioned, but we've also done some metal protease inhibitors that have had angiogenesis effects. We've done lots and lots of things. And what is the primary endpoint of every single one of those trials that preceded the PARP story? Overall survival. And people say, well, why did you make overall survival the primary endpoint for those trials? And the answer was because while it is important for us to extend progression-free survival, we're actually giving patients something that they potentially don't need. And because of that, we potentially give them either a lifelong problem of a toxicity, or since we don't really know who are the patients that are going to respond and who are not, we just give it to everybody and hope it works. Now, the PARPs, to your point, and I'll concede this on the BRCA patients, is that we have come up with a predictive biomarker. The thing that was missing on all of the, and I would say there's probably 15 randomized phase 3 trials that we've done in the maintenance setting that have not extended patients' lives. We have never had a predictive biomarker for those, including for bevacizumab. And within the absence of a predictive biomarker, we are essentially spreading the drug like peanut butter and hoping something sticks. Well, you know, when you take a drug like a PARP inhibitor, which potentially has a long-term toxicity that we are still trying to characterize, namely MDS-AML, you know, we have to take this kind of seriously. So what we have decided on in the world of PARP is that we have come up with a predictive biomarker that can help to identify those patients. But even in the patients that we know are BRCA positive, after a certain point in time, we are giving the drug, and I think that time is about a year, we're giving the drug to people who are no longer going to benefit. So why are we doing it? Right? If we have not extended overall survival in that group of patients, then we are, it's a sacrifice bunt, right? We're moving players around the base, but we haven't really affected long-term outcomes and we potentially subject them to toxicity. That's the primary debate that I think underscores the maintenance setting. Now, PARP has raised the bar because we do have a predictive biomarker. And I do think in my heart of hearts that, you know, because patients are gaining progression-free survival advantages in multiple subsequent lines of therapy, including from frontline on beyond, is that it may ultimately translate. But a very credible argument in this story is that the majority of patients who progress on either treatment, either whether they got a PARP or not, are going to go on to a subsequent line of therapy. And if we catch up in the end, what was the point? So I think that the toxicity and the benefit as measured in progression-free survival, you know, are important considerations. We feel that the trade-off on the toxicity versus efficacy is in the favor of the patient. And that's why it's in those recommendations. So it's necessarily hard to argue that, but I do think that there's a credible argument, and there are people who feel this way, that in the absence of identifying overall survival and not knowing what the long-term toxicity is from PARP inhibitors, that we need to be, you know, we need to be able to counsel patients appropriately that these are issues that they may need to face. Last thing I'll mention is as I mentioned, the biomarker for BRCA status, whether it's in the germline or, you know, identified as in the tissue only, that seems to be a very credible biomarker. You're right that the description of what is HR deficient in the absence of a BRCA mutation or one of the associated homologous recombination genes is muddier. It does lead to false positives and false negatives. With the selection of the criteria that's in the indication for PALA1 and using bevacizumab in combination with olaparib is based on a cut point that seems to be in the middle that discriminates those, but it's not optimized. And so I think we have to have a credible conversation, a frank and credible conversation with our patients that we don't really know exactly which of our patients who fit the profile of HR deficiency outside of BRCA mutation that, you know, would benefit. And I think these are all points that we would bring up in any counseling discussion. And I think it's important to understand that when you see progression-free survival curves that do show that with long-term follow-up, the tails of those curves start to come back together, it's describing that that we have not necessarily changed the biology of the tumor. And because of that, we may not be able to actually see an improvement in overall survival. So what I would say is that my strategy in patients for whom, how this decision process happens, is that a patient, you know, let's say it gets operated on, and then we have to make a decision at that point in time as to what we're going to do, right? So we give those patients, we know we're going to give them platinum-based chemotherapy. That's the best strategy. The question is, do we use Bev or not, right? And what are the criteria that we use to help inform us? Well, we have germline status, and we can get somatic or tissue-based status and HRD status within the first month or two. So then, but we had to have made a decision. So one of the things we do in the post-op setting is go through the first cycle with chemo alone, try to get as much information before cycle number two, and decide if we're going to add Bev or not. If we do, then I think we have another discriminating tool, which is the homologous recombination test. And if we're comfortable with that test, it allows us to make the decision of who to add olaparib to or not. So this is a case where we may not use a PARP inhibitor, because we've identified those patients as HR proficient, and we've already started them on an effective maintenance strategy, which is bevacizumab. That would be a case where we might forego it. On the other hand, if we're not a believer in Bev and we want to just give chemotherapy, we can still do the same test and still hope that we'll get all of our answers so that when we get to the point of maintenance therapy, if the patients have not progressed, then we'll have the opportunity to introduce a PARP inhibitor at that point. But as you mentioned, you could give them niraparib. But the question is that the most effective therapy? And I don't know. You're right. It's just significant. Wasn't an actually powered endpoint of the test. And as you'll note it, that none of the trials that we have in the frontline study have actually identified the HR proficient group of patients as a statistical endpoint. They're all done in post hoc analysis. I would say that I'll concede on the BRCA. On the others, I think you have to have a very serious conversation about what benefit you are giving your patient.
Right. So the problem I have with this, and I appreciate your points, the problem I have with this is it's a good argument for a math class or a statistics class, but we're talking about patients, right? So number one, overall survival is a biased endpoint. It's biased in the fact of crossover. Even in the earliest of PARP trials, even when PARPs weren't even on the market, there was high crossover. Now with PARPs on the market, patients in these trials that don't get PARP inhibitors get PARPs before they essentially succumb from their disease. So you're contaminating the non-PARP group to getting a PARP. So as I talked about with silos, you know, just because they're not getting in the first line, these patients are getting PARPs later on, and that's affecting their overall survival. Secondly, your assumption is based on the fact that overall survival is better than PFS, but I would argue that that's a pure endpoint. Secondly, you're eliminating the possibility. Your argument is eliminating the possibility that Bev plus PARPs work better than either of them alone. So I agree with your comment that bevacizumab is an active maintenance therapy. So why bother changing it? Well, I would argue change it because you could get something that's even better. And sometimes, you know, 1 + 1 = 3, not necessarily 2, or not necessarily double the side effects without it. So the pile of data, even though it's missing a crucial arm, an olaparib-only maintenance arm, there is evidence to support that Bev plus PARPs, which you could do in those patients, if you're a Bev user, you can do easily, just continue the Bev and add the olaparib, you know, may work better than either alone. So saying that you're on a therapy doesn't exclude those patients that you can just add a PARP to. I think you're making my job a little bit easier too by arguing against the HRD. You know, I would say, yes, we don't have a good HRD test yet, and maybe it's not as reproducible, but I would also say that some of the HRD positive data is just as good as almost as good as the pure BRCA data. And maybe the difference, maybe the fact that their hazard ratios are 0.1 or 0.2 off from the BRCA alone data, maybe that's really a result due to the bad testing technique that we have, and maybe some of those patients aren't. But without a perfect test, are you going to not offer those patients a benefit if they're quote unquote HRD positive? Are you going to say, well, you know, 10% of you might not work, so we're not going to give it to any of you?
So you brought up some very good points. And I think that, obviously clinicians will use these non-statistically powered endpoints to make decisions. And there is definitely a hazard in that. And what I'm specifically referring to is that the HR proficient alone and the HR deficient BRCA wild type are subgroups of patients that were not statistically powered to address those questions, right? So, and I think we need to be very careful in making those jumps. It's so tempting. I get it. It's so tempting. But what I'll tell you is that we do not have very many examples where subgroups were found to be positive in a phase 3 trial and then were formally tested in a phase 3 setting and were still positive. And that just goes to speak to the why we call those hypothesis generating. They're good points to look on, but if you, as you say, care about your patient, you need to be certain that you aren't harming that person and that you're actually giving them something that is beneficial. So I think that's one point. And that covers the HRD and the HRP kind of subgroup analyses. The other thing I'll just mention just briefly is that one of the problems with giving Bev and then switching to a PARP, which I know people do, and I'm not gonna be critical of that, but I do want people to understand that in GOG-218, we had an arm that did Taxol Carbo Bev followed by placebo. And what we found is that was no better than Taxol Carbo placebo followed by placebo, and it was more toxic. So giving somebody a more toxic regimen just so that you can get them to the point to switch to a PARP inhibitor doesn't make a lot of sense to the patient. Just don't give them Bev. But your point's taken.
And I'm not saying stop the Bev. I'm saying add the PARP to the Bev.
But we did that in Paolo 1, and that subgroup didn't get a benefit. So, but I think it's a good message, though. And I appreciate that, you know, a lot of us, as you say, without having, you know, going through the exercise of form of developing another phase 3 study to address these specific subgroups, it is really hard to ignore, you know, the data that you see, because it's all presented. And while it's hypothesis generating, people can see those curves. You know, they may not have P values associated with them, and they shouldn't have P values, but they have hazard ratios and you can see how they split.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. Maintenance therapy for all patients with ovarian cancer, yes or no?
So you said all. I can't say yes to that, but I would say
all advanced stage ovarian cancer.
I would say, yeah, for most patients that have don't have toxicity to one of our strategies, yes.
Knowing what you know today, patient with advanced stage recurrent of ovarian cancer, would you put them on HRP, known HRP? Would you put them on a PARP inhibitor or a first line clinical trial looking at immunotherapy as maintenance?
Well, right now I would not. I mean, I think if the clinical trial actually had something different to offer than what we already have in our domain, you know, from Javelin 100 and from Imagine 50, then I would. So I wouldn't do it as a single agent. but I would do it as if it had another agent that was combined with it that made sense, like TIGIT or, you know, some other part.
Okay, so HRP, advanced ovarian cancer, extensive bowel surgery that you don't want to give Bev to.
So PARP or nothing, right?
Yep.
So, and I think that's a fair question. You know, I think it's, again, it gets back to a counseling issue. I would be very frank about the niraparib data in that, just as I mentioned before, I feel that a patient who had that kind of disease is at high, very high risk to recur. And we don't really have, you know, an effective strategy there other than what you just mentioned. So I would have considered for, you know, as the tumor went away in the frontline setting, giving them Bev. So adding Bev in and continuing Bev maintenance, or giving niraparib, or doing observation. I think all of those would be fair choices. You know, taking off my con, you know, pro con, and just talking about patient management, I do think that, and I have a nice graphic of this that shows, you know, half of our patients will recur in the platinum sensitive space between 6 and 18 months. 50% without maintenance. So these are 50% of our patients are recurring within that early platinum sensitive space, 6 to 18 months. So in that 6 to 18, so not the primary platinum refractory, but the patients who actually, you know, got a response, didn't recur within 6 months. Between that 6 month and the next year, about half of those patients are going to recur. Mm-hmm. So we know that, and this is why the premium of identifying an effective maintenance strategy is so important. That's why we're having this conversation today.
Right.
Because we want to somehow flatten that curve.
Right.
And so the best thing we've come up so far has been the PARP inhibitors. And the second best thing is that we've identified a few biomarkers for which those drugs seem to have the most efficacy. And our hope is that in the future, as we start to extend out multiple lines of therapy, that we will see an OS. So, you know, taking off my con hat, I think, you know, I am hopeful that these drugs and their combinations will lead to lasting outcomes.
Yep. No, I appreciate that. I mean, you see, it's easy to take off the con hat. I just can't take off the pro hat. Last question. I know we have to wrap it up soon. What about the theory that some of our colleagues have, you know, again, let's readdress the platinum, increase in the platinum free interval. You know, so by getting that, you know, 5 months, by extending the, making it from 5 months to 8 months, you're essentially giving second line therapy, you're allowing a platinum backbone versus not. Do you think that makes a difference?
No, to be honest with you. You know, and again, this is not a new concept, right? We've been talking about extending. I have, for those of you who know me, GOG-213, before it was GOG-213, was a protocol called GOG-202. And GOG-202, one of the primary endpoints of that trial was extending the platinum free interval.
Okay.
Purposefully extending the platinum free interval. And so so here's the reason I say that I'm not optimistic that that's going to be meaningful is that as the patients live longer and longer, as you mentioned before, the crossover starts to become an impact. It's very hard to have the expectation of 4 to 5 lines of subsequent lines of therapy that you would actually be able to preserve that 3 month progression-free survival. We don't have trials that are big enough to be able to preserve that effect. And we've shown that in, you know, various statistical models. I think that the biology between a 5 month and an 8 month recurrent patient's tumor are very similar.
Yeah, and I'll just say, I disagree. So I think platinum free intervals, it doesn't matter to increase your responses to the platinum, but what it does is it leaves platinum in your armamentarium. It leaves it in the closet, where in our minds, we always take platinum, we always cross it off our list in someone who's recurred at 5 months.
What are you talking about? I don't do that. Come on.
A lot of our colleagues, right?
Because that's got activity both platinum sensitive and resistant.
I'll disagree with the concept of increasing the platinum free interval if you leave platinum in your closet. But if you take it out because they recur within 6 months, then I think there's a benefit because.
Yeah, that's why I think we're trying to get away from the 6 month definition. You know, we made that up, and actually the initial trials that evaluated that at that particular time point did not use 6 months. It was less than 3 to 12, 12 to 18, and 18 plus.
Yep.
So I'm with you.
Okay. I appreciate that. I'm really enjoying this because you forgot more than I know about ovarian cancer. That last question, recurrent patient, platinum free interval is 5 months. If you have two choices, topotecan or carboplatin, what do you choose?
Carbo.
Okay. Platinum free intervals, 4 months.
It's really only the patients that progress on or within 3 months, in my opinion, because those patients essentially have, if you stop therapy at the end of chemotherapy and you got an observation, then you have achieved a response, right? And once they get past that first interval, the 3 month interval, and they haven't recurred, then whatever persistent disease was there has not gotten to the point where you can actually tell. When you start getting past that 3 month, and you know, 4 months is, it was probably there then.
Yep.
I do think that obviously, you know, I don't want to just pull out the clinical trial argument, but this is, you know, is the place where clinical trials really should be done, right? Yep. But if you only had platinum versus a non-platinum, I wouldn't, you know, depending on the antecedent toxicity, I think that a non-platinum and a platinum in that space would be equal. Well, thanks for joining me. And, you know, it's always great to spar with your friends. But, and I think, I hope that the audience got, you know, got the sense of, you know, where these are the questions that are coming up in their minds. I know, because it comes up in my mind. And I really appreciate you helping me, you know, kind of go through the data and, you know, provide the points of view for the audience. It's great to have you on. And thanks for joining me.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's a lot of fun.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this special episode of Onc Live On Air, sponsored by GlaxoSmithKline. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Onc Live is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Onc Live and Onc Live SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Onc Live and Onc Live State of the Science Summit, and follow our Onc Live page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Onc Live On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.